and then jump to our subcommittee update. And when our technical support comes back and gets that connected, we will put a pause on the subcommittee report and we'll go to our first item on the agenda, which will be our presentation on the Utah Women in Higher Education Study, which is online for those who would like to look at that online in anticipation of the presentation. The website is women.utah.gov, and it's online at that site. Yeah, so go ahead and look at that if you'd like to before we get going. So, do we have a motion from our minutes of February 7th? Let's see, Commissioner Freaking, is that your mic?
Yes, I will make the motion to accept the minutes.
Okay, thank you. A motion on the minutes. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. So our minutes are adopted, and thank you very much, Shelley, as always, for your thoroughness in getting those to us. Let's start with our subcommittee updates, and I think we're going to do our policy piece at the end of the meeting, because that's more of a collaborative discussion. Do we have anything from our communications subcommittee? Let me get your light on there.
Where do I begin?
Commissioner Barnett.
Thank you. As you are aware, we have decided during the legislative session to post many of the bills that in concept that we agreed with. That became a little bit challenge. We got it done. But I think next year we have another plan. We may have an intern that will help us. We are now in the process of working with getting some really diverse pictures of various women in various careers to be able to, that's who we represent here. And we're working the interactive has been just so great with posting bills and taking bills off and correcting things. So, and also in the next few months, I'll be reaching out to you folks for a short bio and something about yourself, but also why and what you'll be doing on the commission. So we'll be doing that in a few months. And if there are any questions, we haven't formally met, just
okay. That sounds great. As far as the photos go, if we were aware of photos or were in at an event or a function where there could be some photos taken that could represent some of the diversity that you're talking about, then we have permission from the individuals that would be in those photos, would you like people to be aware of that and send those to you?
I want to have a page that's got the photos on them. I think your press conference that you had during the legislature, that would have been really wonderful to put on there, but I didn't have any, you know, anything, but next time.
I know that we had our communications persons from the different caucuses take some photos, so I'll make a point of that. We should send those to you, because I know that Ross and Andrea, I'm sure they were all taking photos as we were doing the press conference, because we were loading those up on the Facebook page. So I think that would be helpful. We'll make sure that we get those to you. We can add those to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. I think as long as everyone's aware of that, we can fill that quite readily, I'm sure.
Can I just get a few words before we get started? It looks like we're getting close. And first of all, I just want to thank everybody that's here, including members of the media, and I want to thank Kathy and the team from DWS for arranging for individuals to come talk about the rollout and the findings of the second research project that the Women in the Economy Commission has done. What I want to do is just for new people that are here who are not familiar with the commission, I want to give you a little bit of a backgrounder of the commission, why we do what we do, and why today's unveiling of the detailed research on women in education is so important to feeding the policy work that we do as well as the advocacy work that we do. The commission, my
computer just beside that. What are we doing here with this? Yeah, that's lovely. So if you go to women.utah.gov, that will give you a backgrounder on the Women in the Economy Commission. Oh my heck. Yeah, this is really interesting.
Thank you.
There must be ghosts in this room. Something going on. Anyway, we've got a variety of research briefs, the first of which was one that was conducted in conjunction with the YWCA and the Ken Gardner Policy Institute, which conducted a variety of focus groups throughout the state to assess what women's perception, what types of roadblocks exist in terms of their ability to fully actualize their potential in terms of their earning power, their ability to achieve whatever career or academic aspirations they may have. And that focus group, the findings from those focus groups was released a year or so ago. That report is also on our website. But for today's report, this one too is also the Women, Utah Women in Higher Education, a progress report. Is also that the written piece of briefing, the research brief itself, is on our website. So for anybody that's listening in, for folks that are here as interested observers and as members of the press, you can also refer to the women.utah.gov website to be able to pull down detailed information on that research brief to complement the presentation that Dr. Jepson is going to provide for us today. So we work in the area of research that feeds our direction to our colleagues on the Hill, as well as to our agencies, as well as to the public sector, in terms of how they can open doors, how they can take down barriers for women and their families, again, to achieve their full potential in terms of providing for their families and for themselves. So that, in essence, is the genesis of the Women in the Economy Commission, which was established by state law in 2014. Our former Speaker of the House, Rebecca Lockhart, as well as Minority Leader Jennifer Selig in 2014, established the commission. And you will see that we have commissioners representing both small and large corporations and businesses, people from the labor community, people from workforce development, people from higher education that serve on our commission, as well as with a representative from the YWCA, as we know that there are so many roadblocks in terms of social determinants that impede women and their families from, again, being able to pursue their dreams in being able to provide for their families. So I just wanted to get that background because I'm seeing some new faces here in the crowd today. I thank you for being here, but I hope that you'll follow our work. This year we did a lot in regard to following policies and pieces of legislation that our colleagues set forth and tried to connect the dots for those in the community as well as other colleagues as to why we were supporting certain pieces of legislation during the session that, again, underlay and provide a foundation of support for women and their families. So policies, research, communication, networking, and collaboration. Those, in essence, are the pieces of the Women in the Economy Commission. So thank you for being here today and for following our work.
Thank you. That's a really great background. I appreciate that. So one of those, as Co-Chair Chavez have just said, we have the three subcommittees, policy, communications, and research. And so we just heard the presentations from the communications, and it looks like we have just witnessed an April 3rd miracle, and we are ready to go. Thank you very much. We're going to turn on your mics up there, and we'll put a pause on our subcommittee report. Then we are now, I've got both of those mics on for you. Dr. Jepson, welcome. Thank you for being here with us, and we're just going to turn the time over to you.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Pull the mic closer to you. Yeah.
Is that better?
Get right to it. Get your mouth right on it. There you go.
Okay. Okay. Get real cozy.
Okay.
There you go.
We're going to be back in a second. Thank you so much. So I've been really grateful to be able to participate in this research, and for you for helping to fund this and to make this a reality, and also Susan Madsen, who has just spent years and years in a labor of love trying to increase women's educational attainment in Utah. And I know that we've made progress because of these efforts and because of the efforts that you mentioned by the YWCA, by the research done by the Gardner Policy Institute, and by so many others in the state who care about this and who are really working to make the context better for Utah men and women and families. So I wanted to start with some background on this. Some of the things that have changed over the past 10 or 20 years in the Utah population context is that the population has become more diverse. Fertility levels have decreased, and we've increased in racial and ethnic diversity, in cultural diversity, and really the landscape at a population level is becoming different. We still are distinct from the rest of the nation, but we aren't the same Utah that we were 20 years ago. We're also making progress toward the state's goal of having 66% of adults in Utah having a post-secondary certificate or degree. Despite these changes and these gains, Utah businesses are reporting that they don't have the educated workforce they need to fill their jobs. And we also see that even though we've made gains and we see progress in Utah and among Utah women, we don't look so great when different organizations make national rankings. We tend to be towards the bottom on those lists that have to do with women's educational and economic opportunities and conditions. So these were some of the questions that led into our research. Our specific study questions were wanting to understand what the context is for men and women in Utah. What does their attainment, what do their higher educational opportunities look like? How do Utah women compare to U.S. women in their educational attainments? And what are the more specific characteristics of Utah women's educational attainments, such as field of study and length of degree or certificate? And then how have these things changed over time? We also wanted to help reconcile some of the disparate findings that we see that result from looking at different data sets or having different research questions. We wanted to bring together several different data sets to try to come up with a unified picture of what that higher education context looks like for women in Utah. So we looked at three data sources. The first one is at a population level. This is the American Community Survey. It's the it used to be the long form of the census, but this is where we get information about the population in Utah as a whole. We also looked at institutional level characteristics. So each institution of higher education that receives federal funding is required to submit surveys on a regular basis, and so we looked at the institutional reports. And then we also received permission to access the Utah System of Higher Education data on individual students. This is anonymized and is not reported at an individual level, but we still were able to get individual level insights from this. So at these three levels of analysis, we get different pictures, and we're able to see at these different levels maybe why some of the numbers that we see in the media or in different reports are different. We want to clarify that numbers will be different depending on what level of analysis we're looking at, population, institution, or individual. So our findings from that population level data show that we're making good progress. Men's graduate degree and women's associate degree attainment are kind of some outliers. Men are doing really well at graduate degree attainment, and women are superstars at associate degree attainment. And as I'll show in a slide, the gap between men's and women's bachelor's degree attainment has recently been eliminated. And I again want to highlight the work that Dr. Susan Madsen and her team have done. They have spent years researching why women weren't finishing bachelor's degrees at the same in the same proportion that men were, and we see that that gap at that level has decreased. We also find, though, that at this population level, when women are married and when women have children, those things are associated with having lower educational attainment. And we see that, again, Utah women are just the best at getting associate degrees, and Utah men are they surpass the rest of the nation in getting graduate degrees. So in this first figure, I want to show you that, and this is from the Long Report, which I know it's quite long, but I think it's fun to read. So I hope everybody will look at that if they are so inclined. But this figure is from that report, and we see that from 2001 to 2009, the percent of Utah men who had a bachelor's degree was higher than the percent of Utah women who had a bachelor's degree. Now, on the next chart, I'm going to show you a combination of degrees. But when we look at just holding a bachelor's degree, this is where a few years ago when people were talking about the problem of women not having the bachelor's degree attainment that men had, this is one of the figures that we were looking at. And then we see that as of 2012, from 2012 to 2015, even though these differences aren't statistically significant, meaning that they're not big enough to say that it's a real difference, we see that on these data, women actually surpass men in bachelor's degree attainment. So given that these differences aren't statistically significant from 2009, it's accurate to say that since 2010, men's and women's bachelor's degree attainment, or the percent of Utah adults who are men and women who hold only a bachelor's degree, is about the same. But when we add in the graduate degrees, this is where we see a bigger difference between men and women, and I'm also here on this chart comparing U.S. men and U.S. women. So the blue line is Utah men, and when we say at least a bachelor's degree, that's including their graduate degrees, and because they earn so many graduate degrees, or so many men earn graduate degrees, compared to Utah women and to the rest of the nation, they're the highest. Because Utah women don't earn as many graduate degrees, when we compare them to the rest of the nation, they're at the bottom. And then U.S. men and U.S. women are closer in there. So it's important when we think about post-secondary educational attainment to think about what are we measuring? Are we measuring who has a bachelor's degree? Are we measuring what's the highest degree that somebody has earned or that is earned in a population? Are we measuring an average level in a population? All of these things will have different numbers, and depending on what we want to change, we might have different focuses. And I hope it's also a little reassuring that even though we don't rank very well on these national comparisons or these lists that seem to come out every few months, we are making progress. So at the institutional level, using the IPES data, we found that Utah women make up a larger percent of enrolled students compared to Utah men in private, nonprofit, and for-profit institutions. And consistent with what we found with the HCS data, what Utah women are completing a greater proportion of those shorter degree and certificate programs compared to Utah men. Utah women, when we compare Utah women to U.S. women, they represent a smaller proportion of fall enrollment, and Utah women compared to Utah men and compared to U.S. women have lower participation in the STEM fields like engineering and math. So again, this helps us highlight that relative to Utah men, women have made up a lot of ground. Relative to U.S. women, Utah women have not.
Catherine, can I interrupt second and ask you a question clarifying? On your second point here, Utah women complete a greater proportion of shorter degree certificate programs. Mm-hmm. So on the previous set of slides, it was associate degrees, mm-hmm. then bachelor's degrees, and graduate degrees.
Right.
On the associate degrees, does that also include certificates and degrees from our applied technology colleges here in Utah?
In the American Community Survey, it does not. That's not something that's measured in that data source. In the IPES data and in the Utah System of Higher Education data, it does.
Okay, so from here on out, when it's talking about the associate, the shorter degree, mm-hmm. that would loop those in?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's another important, if we have a goal as a state to include certificates in that 66%, we should be careful about which data source we're using to measure our progress on reaching that goal. Yeah. So thank you, great question.
Yeah, and I think that speaking to the 66% of the goal of having 66% of Utah adults having a post-secondary certificate or degree, I think that the certificate piece of that has been kind of highlighted and re-emphasized of late in the past year or so. It was always included, but it has been, the need for that has been an additional focus. So it is
not just degrees, it is certificates, you know, something post-secondary in high school.
Right.
So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And when we looked at the Utah System of Higher Education data sets, we found that we could tease out some differences in persistence. So this was the data set that lent itself better to looking at both individual level paths, because we're not looking at a population level like with the ACS, and we're not looking at an institution level. And we did see that of the Utah men and women who initially intended to earn a bachelor's degree when they were first registered as a student in a UG institution, a greater proportion of those Utah women eventually earned an associate's degree, and a greater proportion of the Utah men earned a bachelor's degree. We also saw that Utah men are more likely, consistent with the other data sets, to pursue fields of study such as engineering and business, and Utah women were more likely to pursue education and also health sciences like medical assisting, speaking to that certificate level. And Utah men and women, we saw in this data set, also with the ACS, they're experiencing different patterns of persistence and completion. So they're not persisting toward their degree in the same way. They are stopping out, or they're taking longer or shorter time to continue and to make progress toward a degree or certificate, and they aren't completing in the same patterns. We saw in the ACS that there were associations between family formation activities, like marriage and having children, for men and women. Those were different. Those acted differently for men and women toward their educational attainment. We can't say why that is. We can't say that family formation changed somebody's educational goals, because we don't have that kind of data. We can't say that people who had different family formation orientation had different educational goals to begin with. We can't, this data can't answer those questions, but we can see that there are different things that work for men and women. And so in our goals to help men and women persist and complete their educational goals, we can't have a one-size-fits-all solution. So we outlined some concerns in the brief and in the broader report, but a few of the main ones are that even though Utah women are doing well compared to themselves over time and compared to Utah men, and just want to reiterate that it's not a contest, they're not doing well compared to U.S. women. And I think this brings up some great questions. Are Utah women different from U.S. women? Do we have structures that make it harder for Utah women to reach their educational goals? Do we have cultural differences? But as we see a changing demographic face of Utah, and as we see a changing culture in Utah, if we're becoming more like the rest of the nation in many different metrics, what's holding Utah women back from reaching the parity with U.S. women in their educational attainment? We also see that Utah women pursue fields of study and certificate and degree links that are associated with poor economic outcomes. There's some research that suggests that Utah women are participating in the labor force at the same level or more than U.S. women. How can we better prepare them to have better economic outcomes? If they're going to participate in the labor force, do they have the resources to help prepare them for that participation? And then both Utah men and Utah women experience obstacles in their pursuit of higher education. And we need more research to find out what those obstacles are and how to affect change for both Utah men and women.
I have a really quick question, if I can.
Yeah.
So in talking about additional impediments, were you able to tease out financial support? So in terms of, we're looking at outcomes, and if you start out with the inability to pay tuition or to get child care to support the fact that you are going to classes, et cetera, et cetera, were we able to tease out any of that type of those variables that might affect the ability for women to complete and to pursue maybe some of the more rigorous curricula
right.
Tracks?
Yeah, great question. So the American Community Survey does include information on poverty level, and so we did find associations between poverty level and likelihood of being enrolled and holding higher educational attainment. And so being in poverty, maybe there was a negative association, right? So people in poverty were less likely to be persisting to, or to be enrolled in school and to have a higher degree. There's also research, though, that you mentioned earlier that you commissioned from the Gardner Policy Institute that's qualitative, where focus groups and interviews were done, where those concerns did come up, that women weren't able to participate in higher education or in the labor force to the extent that they wanted to because of the cost of childcare. So in this data, that wasn't something that we could see that properly, but there is that other research, the qualitative research that that you commissioned, and then there are also national groups that find that when there is, for example, on-campus childcare available to parents, or when there are other things that make it easier for parents to pursue their education, they do so at a higher rate.
Thank you.
Thank you. So back to the question of reconciling the findings. When we are comparing statistics, when we're comparing results and change over time especially, we need to remember to consider the level of data collection and analysis. So for example, we wouldn't want to compare population level findings with institutional level findings. And then also recognize the context of post-secondary educational activities. And by that I mean that there's a larger constellation of institutional forces or cultural forces that affect what people do. I think that we all want to make it easier for men and women to exercise their preferences. And whatever those preferences are should be able to be determined among individuals and families. But if there are structural constraints that make it harder for people to exercise those preferences, that's an area where we deserve additional research and where I think we can make up some ground. I hope that we can also think about how we can better prepare Utah women for their eventual labor force participation. And then think about how we can support Utah families as men and women pursue their higher education and labor force activities. Do you have any additional questions?
Thank you. That concludes your presentation.
Thank you.
That is a brief presentation on a very, very interesting document.
Thank you.
And the data in there is very helpful for us and for people across the state looking at these issues. I think we probably have lots of questions. I'm just going to start with one. How do you see this data complementing the qualitative research that you mentioned that was done by the Kenzie Gardner Institute? How should we look at both of those together see a more complete picture, or talk about how they complement each other?
Right. So I'm a huge fan of mixed methods research. I think that combining qualitative, like interview and focus group data, with quantitative data, like the census data that I looked at and the other survey data, is the best way to get a whole picture of society, of different phenomena. And when we see these gaps in the quantitative data, I think it's easy to say, well, aren't men and women choosing their degree fields? Aren't they choosing how long they're in school? Aren't they, you don't see barriers in the quantitative data. And then when you talk to men and women, when you talk to the women that were in the focus groups at the Gardner Policy Institute held, and they talk about why they aren't making other choices, and if those have to do with financial considerations like the cost of childcare, or the availability of high-quality childcare, we can give a little bit more substance to those quantitative findings.
Great. Thank you. I think since our press is here and being timely, being sensitive to their time, we're going to go to Amber Bird for her presentation, and then at the end of that, maybe bring both of you up for the full complement of questions from the committee members, commission members.
Yeah, and then Kathy.
Yes, we want you as well. We'll take our full complement of questions after a presentation from Amber Bird and also Kathy Bonus. So thank you
so much.
Yeah. and either place. Yep. You can just leave your things there, Dr. Justin, and just introduce yourself.
Okay.
And we'll get your mic on, and
just like she did, go ahead and get that mic nice and close so everybody can hear you.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah. And just introduce yourself and then make your presentation. Thank you.
My name is Amber Bird, and I am a student and I'm a mom, and I'm trying to figure out this whole education world. For as long as I can remember growing up, I always knew that I wanted to go to school, to the point where I would make worksheets for my little brother to do during the summer. He didn't think it was a good idea, but I loved school. And it wasn't until I was pregnant with my daughter that I felt for the first time in my life like I did not belong at school anymore. And it was something that was really hard for me to admit to myself, that becoming a mom in some way made me feel like I was disqualified for going to school. And I have had friends that I've talked to and have shared similar feelings that for women, life and your pursuits and who you want to become almost end once you get married. And if you have the desire to have children, then education has to stop them too. And something that has become really important to me is having the courage to keep going through school and to show my daughter that she can do something more. And if her dreams require more education or more time, that she can be a mom if that's what she chooses and continue learning and growing. So she was born during my senior year, during my undergrad, and one of the hardest things that we had to face is figuring out where she was going to go. And a lot of worries and a lot of struggles and phone calls and visiting places, and we were very blessed to have an opportunity to take her to an in-home daycare and to find a woman who loves taking care of her. And I know that not very many people have that opportunity, and that something like childcare really does become a challenge that you have to overcome. And I know for me, it wasn't easy, because for those, when I would be in class or be in situations where I would be teaching or trying to pursue and finish my degree, the question was always, well, who's watching your kids? And on the flip side of that, I'm the only girl in my family, so I have lots of brothers. And as they've continued on their education, they never have that question. And I think that that's something that needs to be acknowledged, that kids in tow doesn't make a woman any less able to accomplish something. And I learned finishing my undergrad that that was something that I wanted to stand up and say something about. I am currently pregnant with our second child, and it is due in August, and in the following September, I've decided to start a master's program, and so I'm going to keep going because that's who I feel like I need to be, and that me, as a mother, can do more good for my children, accomplishing something and being successful, and not pushing my dreams aside, so that I can teach them what they need to do too, and that they have pursuits, and that education can be a key to unlocking those dreams. A lot of times I hear my friends or other moms talk about how they want a part-time job or a job that's flexible so they can just work when the kids are at school or after the kids are grown. And I thought a lot about that path and a lot about how my life would look like if I pursued that. And I sincerely believe that taking the time now to pursue higher education at this point in my life and pursuing the career that I intend to have, I want to be an English professor, so that's kind of weird, but and pursuing that career will actually give me the flexibility and the opportunity to be the mom that I want to be, rather than one that's tied to this job that doesn't fulfill me as a person and isn't giving me the opportunity to be the mom that I want to. So that's my story, and that's why I feel like I can't stop going to school until I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be. And I believe that in the end it's something that will give back, not just to my family, but to the community and to the economy and to the state in general. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I don't think we could have put a capstone to all of this any better than that. Amber, thank you so much for your inspirational thoughts and for your ambition and where you see yourself and how you see that impact your family and your daughter and your children in particular. So thank you for sharing your thoughts, and best of luck with you this last year and as you pursue your master's degree. Thank you very much. And this puts a face on my qualitative data matters. Yeah, thank you. Commissioner Bonas, you want to put that from there or down?
From here.
From there, okay. How about with the mic? Which one are you? There we go.
From here, if that's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll try to be as quick as possible, but I'm going to get pretty personal with some details, and that goes against my normal character, so bear with me as I work through nerves. I grew up in Twin Falls, Idaho, in a very low socioeconomic situation. My father was on disability, he didn't work, and he was addicted to painkillers. My mother didn't have an education past high school, and she worked two low-wage jobs to put food on the table, and I didn't see her very often. We were hungry and we were dirty and we were poor. At the age of 17, I had my daughter during my senior year of high school. And I didn't have any insurance and I didn't qualify for Medicaid. And so 30 days after I had her, my credit was ruined because I couldn't pay the hospital bills. So here I am, senior year of high school. I'm a mom, I'm poor. I'm working at McDonald's. What am I doing? So I transferred to the alternative high school because they have daycare there, so you can bring your kid with you and still obtain high school diploma. So I did that. I graduated on time. I didn't miss a beat there. I attempted to do 1 year of school at this College of Southern Idaho in Twin Falls. I got through one semester while working full-time, being a mom full-time, and going to school full-time. Sorry. Second semester I had to drop. I couldn't handle all of that pressure. And I was pretty lost. My brother lived in Provo, offered free rent if I wanted to move down to Utah, and I could not pass up that deal, so I moved down to Provo and got a job as a computer tech. Surprisingly, I know nothing about technology, but that's what my job was. And then I got married 10 months after that and had my second child 11 months after that, and then my third child 2 years after that. So at the age of 22, I had 3 kids. My husband did not have a high school diploma. My husband at the time did not have a high school diploma or any other higher education, and we were poor. When my youngest was 1 year old, I just decided, you know what, no more. I'm going to go to school. That'll be good for me and that'll be good for my kids. I applied at the U and they rejected me, which crushed my little spirit because I was so gung-ho. But who did accept me was the Salt Lake Community College, and I can't say good enough things about that establishment because they accepted me. They were the most flexible school that I attended. And they have a daycare on campus, and their schedules were morning, night, online, during summer. I mean, just very, very flexible for, clearly they catered to people who were not the traditional students. So I did 2 years there, 4.0, very proud of myself. make this of you. Will you take me now? And they did. They did take me. So transferring up to the U, I realized throughout my educational experience, the higher I got in my educational timeline, the less flexible the institutions became, the less flexible it was for me, and the harder it was for me to stay in and keep going. At the U, they did have a preschool on campus. My littlest was 3 at the time. My other 2 were school age, so they could go to public school during the day. So I tried to schedule my classes during the blocks of time this preschool was offered on campus. That was hard because they only had a couple hour blocks of time, about 3 hours. And when I hit my major classes, most of them were only offered once, and only at one time slot, once in the semester, and it was usually a precursor to what class I needed to take next. So it became very difficult for me to manage all of that scheduling, in addition to just, you know, being a mom and running a household and taking care of your kids. So I would have liked it if they had more flexibility with their scheduling. None of my majors were offered online in my classes. None of them were offered on night or on weekends. But I graduated. I got my bachelor's in exercise and sports science, and a minor in English literature and English and a minor in nutrition. And then when I left the school after graduating, I thought I never want to step foot on a school campus ever again, because that was the hardest period of time in my life, and my poor kids who had to suffer with me doing homework and not paying attention to them or getting grumpy at them and patients and all of that. And that lasted about 3 months when I decided I wanted to go to law school. And law school is probably, and I hope law schools don't come at me after this for being truthful about it, but I think it's the most inflexible institution there is. I don't know about medical school, but law school is terrible. The first year, I went to J. Lumen Clark, WIU. First year, you do not get to pick your schedule at all. They pick it for you. You don't even pick your classes. They pick the time and your schedule. There's nothing online. There's nothing at night. There's nothing on weekends. There's no summer classes. And so they say you're there from 8 to 4. You have to be there from 8 to 4. There's no child care, there's no preschool, there's nothing like that to help out. And in addition to that, you have about 80 hours of homework a week on top of being in class for that amount of time and then taking care of kids on top of that. I can't describe to you how hard that was. So more flexibility at law schools would be really great. I think we need more female lawyers. In fact, when I passed the bar and was sworn in, I think the statistics at that time were 25% of practicing lawyers in Utah were women, 75% men. I love men, but I wish there was a greater representation of women in that field. During my law school experience, after my first year, you guys remember that Great Recession thing? We all have a memory of that. So my then husband lost his job in 2010, and we had to sell our house and get a non-compete agreement for Utah, which meant he had to move out of state to have a job. So your law school was an adventure, and I'm sure you guys all have your Great Recession stories that were hard. Anyway, suffice it to say, I've been through a lot. It was really hard to get where I am, to get my law degree. I think there are barriers and challenges there that are unnecessary, and that there's simple solutions that we can look for. And this report, I'm so grateful for you, Dr. Jepson and Dr. Madsen, because they donated a lot of their time. When we paid money for the study to be done, but they donated a lot of their personal time to get this report to us. And I think it's going to help us develop policy moving forward. It's going to help us pave a smoother road for women to attain higher levels of education and to realize higher levels of socioeconomic status. And that's a great theme. And I want us to engage in that, and I want us to push forward. And if my story helps, great, because I hate sharing it. But thank you all for being patient and listening. And go, women.
Thank you.
and Amber this morning have really been really brought this issue home. And I can't imagine how gratifying it must be for you to be engaged in the work you are and to be the powerful, the powerful embodiment of the very work that you're engaged in.
Can I say my daughter that I had at 17, junior at the U, today?
I don't say this lightly, but so you.
And if I can just add a couple of things, I know it is difficult for us to share our stories, but I thank you for doing that, and I'm hoping that you will consider finding another venue to tell that story and to continue to do that, both you and Amber and every single woman in this space. Because the thing is that young women that are out there, they need to hear those stories, because right now they feel they're the only ones that are going through what you went through. And when they can see the potential of what happens with resistance, with having others in our community, in our family, in our constellation of supporters who can assist us to get through those tough times, and that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that you can achieve what you want, and then what you're able to do with that, which is what you've been doing in terms of being on the commission, of your role as chief counsel for the Department of Workforce Services. You bring a perspective that I don't think not very many people could, because of your journey. And that feeds how you evaluate the policy that comes before that department. It feeds our work. And it is difficult to share those stories, but it's important for the young women and others who see this. They need to know that it can be done, and you've shown that. So thank you.
Before we have our media break, are there questions or comments from the committee right now? Let's see. Commissioner Barnett?
Well, thank you, and thank you so much. One little snippet here is, it's the guilt that you feel when you're at school, and it's the guilt that you feel when you drop off every morning, and then you just rise to it and say, I'm going to feel guilty, I'm doing this for them. And that's one thing that I think we need to understand. Why do we feel so guilty? And why is it so difficult? Why? Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Just a lot. I feel like it's really been a very eye-opening presentation, and a real privilege to hear your stories. And I think everyone is in their own space right now thinking about their own life experiences and how enriched we are when we share with each other, and how we could spend a lot of time sharing our own experiences that are so diverse but so fraught with every single one of these issues that have been brought up in the report. And so as we think about that, I think next steps, both for our work as a commission, our work in our individual positions at work, or as legislators, I think just a lot that can be informed by what we've heard and learned today. So we are going to take a break here for media out in the hall. Is that how we envision that?
Is that what the plan was? They have some more time to interview folks. And but before we do, I do want to thank Dr. Justin again and Dr. Madsen and everybody that's been associated with the research subcommittee. We have Dr. Furlick, Aaron Jemison, Dr. Robinson. There's others that I may be missing who serve on our research committee that have assisted us in both the prior focus group work and in this particular project.
so much to unveil and so much to put shed light on, and we'll just keep on going, and we're going to keep trying to find those mechanisms to fund and support this research. But it is so sorely needed, as we have seen today by the findings and by the great recommendations in terms of what we need to move forward with as the commission in terms of the work that we do. The research definitely feeds what we do, and it sheds light on why it's needed. So again, Dr. Jensen, Dr. Crowley, and others from the committee, and please extend our thanks to Dr. Madison too, if you would please. Thank you.
So, looking at the time limit. Yeah, 10 minutes.
So if members of the commission and the presenters, let's all just go out there and have a, as we would like to discuss this further. Okay. Will just become available. Let's all just go out there and we'll reconvene at 11:30.
I don't know why we're going to go. You are not. factoring in time off for.
To be here. That's really, really important. I think one thing we can all agree on is how important it is that the findings from this research and the stories of people who are experiencing this, of which there are many, hundreds of thousands in the state, they're so important. So thank you very, very much. We have all three of our presenters, Dr. Jepson, Amber Bird, and Kathy Jones with DWS, still here with us. If there are comments or questions for them, we'll take a few minutes right now and hear them before we move on to our next item on the agenda, which is going to be our subcommittee updates on research from the research subcommittee and then also from the public policy subcommittee and kind of a review of what happened during the legislative session. So that's what we have ahead of us. And so questions or comments, what is...
I think we're all just kind of absorbing everything that we could.
Yeah.
I think that's where I've added that it's just there was so much great information, and then to overlay that with the example is just, I think it's big. I think we're all just kind of going with it and deciding, so now what? What do we do with this? The question was posed to me related to how are we going to get this information to the regions, and I think that's our next hurdle. That's our next objective.
Yeah. So what are our unanswered questions for both for research and then next steps for us as a commission sharing this information? How can we continue to
use it to affect change?
Yeah.
Just why we're here.
Exactly. Let's see, is that Commissioner Robinson?
Yeah. Thank you so much. I would love to see this report sent to every president's office in higher education.
Yes.
At your office. I think that would be wonderful, including our private higher ed institutions. It's so valuable, and I think it should just be front and center in their minds. We have a lot of presidents that are new within the last year or two, one in the last 2 days. And I think this should be a top priority to think about the completion of their students, especially women, and the challenges that exist on their campus to getting their degree completed, whether it's flexible schedules, more online courses, child care that's available. As much as the child care that is available on campus is quality, it is inadequate to fulfill the needs for our students. So I would love it to be a top priority for every president in this country.
What we'll do is we'll draft a letter, a chair's letter, and then if your team can help us get it
sure.
to the president,
yep.
that would
yep.
be great.
Yep.
Super, we'll plan on doing
yeah.
that.
It's a great idea.
We'll have some, hopefully, some great press leaks put on that. I think that'll drive us
home,
too.
We're going
to
see it tonight. Great. Commissioner Escamilla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll also add maybe the governor to that letter and all leadership in the legislature and the education higher ed committee, the committees standing and,
okay.
and the appropriations. Mm-hmm. I think, actually all the legislators should get it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
for sure those, it needs to address them directly to them and the governor, because they continue to talk on this, education plan and 2020, this is not addressed and we're missing 50% of the population that won't be served adequately. And I apologize Because, you know, to walk in and Kathy in tears, I mean,
that happens all the time.
I've known Kathy for 10 years. And so first, I want to apologize. So I will be attending the Governor's Youth of Trade Mexico Trade Mission next week. So we've had a briefing. And as we, you know, so I was sitting in a room with 40 people, which three of them were women, you know, kind of like miss this part of walking into this room and feeling, you know, the emotions of, I mean, of eye-opening moments by sharing stories. So I first want to apologize to Kathy and our guest, Amber. Congratulations on your story, and of course, Dr. Jepson for the study that has been. We've talked so much about this. I have to congratulate the commission, mostly the co-chairs, because I think the Senate has not been as good as the House in terms of leading this commission. And, you know, I just want to take an opportunity, because as it's been now very public, that both of our co-chairs will be in the legislature as of next year. And they know how much I beg them to stay, which hasn't changed their mind. So I obviously do not affect them. I'm not that big of an impact on people that I beg, but it doesn't happen. But, I want to, you know, literally, this has been just a work of love. And the, you know, ending with not only the report and two powerful stories, I think it's wonderful. I hope we actually, I would love to even, maybe the three of us seek some funding for printing this study. And I'm sure we can find that even within the state legislature, because this needs to be discussed beyond the commission. This has to be part of a conversation that, you know, talks about Utah. So I first wanted to apologize for not being here when Kathy presented, because I actually have a lot of respect for her work, and just to see now this personal side of her personal side story makes even more sense of how good of a, you know, staff she's for the Department of Workforce Services, how efficient, effective. I didn't know how she managed all the stuff, and I'm like, oh, now that makes sense. Right? You know, sort of multitask. As a mother, I get it. So now I'm like, oh, my respect 5 notches up. So I just wanted to say thank you to the co-chairs as well, because I think your letter should reflect how many years of work of this commission towards getting here. And why not, I will encourage a conversation, even, or I mentioned the letter of the barriers to even get information and data available. I think it's worthwhile having it part of the conversation in a non-confrontational way. Maybe not, if not going to be writing it, because it would look very different. But you guys are better than me in putting that together, where I think it's important to talk, because that's part of history. So 10 years from now, I hope the individuals that are sitting here are not going to be struggling the same way we struggle and our researchers struggle to get data. And that is very critical, because if we're not changing that culture of accessing information, of transparency, on something that is so critical that it impacts half of our population in the state of Utah, then I feel like we haven't succeeded. So I encourage that our conversation is not only about the findings, but the process, the journey to get to the findings, because it's all about journeys. And if today listening to two separate stories is not about journey, then I don't know what it is. So I encourage that we reflect a conversation about a journey of a commission that was created in statute by the legislature with a mandate to bring more opportunities of economic income, prosperity for women, and how it took us this long because of some of those barriers that are institutionalized. And they may not be ill intent, but they are institutionalized, and we acknowledge that and we need to keep them moving forward. I think that's part of the journey, and I just encourage that we keep on telling stories as part of the solution, because it's hard to understand until you don't talk about a journey. And part of it comes from me being very quiet about my journey of getting DHRM to provide data on salaries, which it sounds like, how is that possible? But now I'm learning that if I'm telling that story, people react and there's more interest. So I encourage we continue that conversation, and we don't just, you know, say, oh, well, you know, now we got this, we're happy. No, I mean, this is a process and we need to talk about it. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have work ahead of us signing. Commissioner Freeman.
Yeah, I was going to make the same comment and thank you for asking me. And actually, the presenters, thank you very much.
Is your for mic on? Your mic.
I think so.
I hear you.
She's just really low. I'm like leaning in that person. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now? thank you for the presenters. I was going to just say that I think that the information and the stories and everything, I mean, I've been on for 2 years now, and it's very compelling, and we have not even scratched the surface. I think we're just now getting a tool and figuring out what the surface is, mm-hmm. and I would encourage us to do further research. I'm really interested in the patterns of persistence. But I'm very, very interested also in what you had mentioned, Representative, around that pattern of persistence and the overlap in terms of economic decisions after that, wages, even when people do persist and have a bachelor's degree, for example, what types of fields are they going into? So I think we have more to research, especially with the family formation patterns as well, seeing if we can get some data to correlate those things. Serving on the subcommittee, I know that the qualitative data was really compelling as well. So I think if I would just make, I don't know, not a motion, but my suggestion is that as we continue to advocate, educate, and create awareness, which I think we've started to do now with where we're at, I would really love us to see a conversation around strategies and what's next and further research so that we can be answering the question if somebody responds to these letters and says, great, this is really good information.
Now what?
Now
what?
What
do you want us to do?
We should hopefully be driving that conversation as well to say, I'm glad you asked. Right? We just finished this study that said we could do this, or this is an interesting thing, let's have this conversation together. So I do think we should do more in terms of going deeper with this and where we've been.
So one thing that I would like to propose that we do is, and I don't know why I haven't thought about this before, but we should spotlight each one of the commissioners and our stories, if you're willing to share them, on the website. So we just do a commissioner spotlight, who we are, what got us to where we're at, because I think each one of us probably has an incredible journey and different stories with which people that look at the website will be able to relate to. And then we can start, you know, widening that web to other individuals like Amber and others who are willing to share their stories on the website. And so I'd like to, if I may, if I'm the communication committee, can't say communication, to work on that with us. If that would be fine, Commissioner Barnett, that would be very. I think that's what I would like to recommend, because I think we forget to, we're so focused on what's out there and the work that we need to do that we forget that we each have our own stories to tell. That encourages others to share too. So that would be one other thing that I would do. And then the chairs take the assignment moving forward of putting together a letter to get to the president's members of the legislature and the executive branch that need to hear the message. So we'll work on that.
I like the idea of having some hard copies, and we can go ahead and get that done on our end here at the legislature. We have a way to do that. I think if you think about other people in the community, other organizations who have a piece or a stake, I mean the institutions of the College of Applied Technology, those folks, maybe businesses, maybe the Chamber, Envision Utah, I mean, people who are Prosperity 2020, Governor's Economic, or Governor's Education Excellence Commission. I mean, this ought to go out far and wide. Anyone who has an interest in this at all, in addition to groups like the YWCA, and the full report, as well as Dr. Jepson, if you'd be amenable to sharing your slides with us, and we can send that out as well. And I'm also wondering if maybe there's an opportunity for us down the road before the next legislative session to conduct some kind of a conference or a seminar or a presentation to invite all of these groups that we're going to be sending this information out to, and in addition to
you know, business leaders and people in the education community to come and hear firsthand the presentation by Dr. Jepson, stories like Amber's and Kathy's and others, and some discussions about what next and what are some changes within education, higher ed, within applied technology colleges, within all of these different spheres, what work can be begun to address some of these.
And I would like to see the research subcommittee. I think it's very fun to see the three subcommittees now being able to take on a similar mission with different tasks and then come together in this body to do the overlap. So I think it'd be really fun to see the research subcommittee come back together with the academicians and the brainiacs.
Bring in the brainiacs
and have part of that conversation.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Okay.
We should do maybe just a brief overview on what we've done with policy, but maybe what we can do, this is what my recommendation would be for, we've got interim committees starting in May, and maybe for our June committee meeting, we can focus on what study items have been assigned to the interim committees with the prism of what we're looking at in terms of policy. What we were able to accomplish and not accomplish, which roadblocks got in our way in terms of the policy directives that we put forward, and we can do a deep dive on what passed and what didn't pass, but then instead of just focusing just on that, saying, okay, now that we know what we ran into, going into interim and going forward, what do we need to do to help make sure that we move these policies forward? But do you want to kind of just do maybe a synopsis of some of the stuff that we... I know that, especially with Representative Edwards, but even with Senator Escamilla, some of our bills, we ran into two bills as institutional roadblocks, of which we've been speaking.
In January, on the first Thursday of the legislative session, on January 25th, we had a press conference where we rolled out what we called the Family Economic Prosperity Package, and we worked with the YWCA, Action Utah, Utah Women's Coalition, others.
Voices,
a great group of legislators. There were 17 bills presented that day from both rural and urban legislators, both sides of the aisle, both House and Senate. And as we looked at those, both Representative Shavitok and I, along with Erin Jemison, Public Policy Director from the YWCA, had an opportunity to present sort of the outcome of the legislative session on some of these pieces of legislation. And many good things did pass, and many good things are still works in progress. And we will continue. And I don't know if Erin, would you like to come up and give a 2 or 3 minute synopsis of the areas of focus for the YWCA and how you see the session through your lens?
Oh, wow! There's no internet
here. Sure. I'm supposed to introduce myself. Sharon Jemison, Director of Public Policy at the YWCA. So our three areas of focus are economic empowerment for women and girls, racial justice and civil rights for women and girls of color specifically, and health and safety for women and girls. So basically any issue that you can think of that impacts women and girls falls under one of those categories. And I would say again, this year, the most significant challenges were around economic empowerment and stability, which I think would be of particular interest to this group. When we look at the legislation that we either led out on or strongly supported and advocated on, that's where we didn't see a lot of success. So one of those would be the intergenerational poverty earned income tax credit. This is, I think, the third or fourth year that bill has been run, and it passed every level, but just was not included in the final tax reform package in terms of what was funded and therefore got out of the session. So that did not pass again this year, even though we did see pretty broad bipartisan support the elimination of food tax, that's another one that didn't end up getting through that we supported. We also looked at a couple of Social Security tax issues. Utah is one of the only states that taxes Social Security benefits, and that disproportionately impacts women. Women make up the majority of the population that depends on Social Security in retirement for their full income. So we've been working with AARP and others on that for a few years, and again, didn't see success with that this year. And then Representative Edwards, I'll let you talk about your paid family and medical leave bill, but that was one where, again, we saw support, but just didn't get it funded in the end. And I call that bill a success because we were having a conversation about paid family leave and had support leading out from the Salt Lake Chamber and other chambers across the state. And I think we only have progress to make moving forward with that issue. In the racial justice arena, we saw some great success with looking at better processes for workplace discrimination claims. Where we ran into obstacles again was an attempt, again, Representative Edwards ran a bill and we worked on for a long time before the session around making sure that any employee is protected by workplace discrimination laws, regardless of how large their employer is. And we ran into a lot of pushback around the burden on small businesses with that. And the concern that false claims is what would really burden small businesses. And I think we have some education to do around how common false claims really are, but also what the process actually looks like and how burdensome it is or isn't. And again, I think it was the first year of many to look at this issue and start educating folks and having that conversation. We had a ton of great success in health and safety. That's really where, if you look at our bill tracker online and in our summary, we have check marks for passing in every single one. So Senator Escamilla pulled a rabbit out of her hat, and the miracle of funding home visiting in the program in the state, which had been getting cut from the federal level, she was able to get funding allocated to continue those programs across the state, which really impacts especially low-income women, especially those who've just had children. So we're really excited about that. The bill signing is this afternoon. And then you all heard a lot about the maternal mental health conversation and the fact that we really just started the conversation this year with a resolution. Senator Zender, with support from Senator Henderson, ran that bill. Representative Chavez House was our floor sponsor, and it passed unanimously at every stage. We had the Dykes family from Utah County come there. They lost their wife and mom 2 years ago. We were able to highlight her story and their story. And really bring attention to the issue. And again, that bill finally this afternoon as well. And her whole family's coming up here again for that. And really just starting the conversation, as Representative Chavez House always says much more eloquently than I can, we're where we were 30 years ago when women were encountering postpartum depression and anxiety. And we really need to start making some movement. And I think this passing this resolution is the beginning of having some awareness on that. And recognizing that it doesn't just impact health, it impacts the family's economic well-being long-term as well. So I think Senator Zender and others are excited to really pass some legislation and some appropriations around that issue moving forward, so we were excited about that. And really, you can't ask me to do anything for 2 minutes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I should last but not least, I would just say, we had a pretty good year with domestic violence legislation. Given that we provide those services at the YWCA, we're always paying attention to those issues, had some great additional protections put into state statute this year in response to a really deadly year in Utah. We had 44 women and children were killed as a result of domestic violence last year. And so, we saw some good progress, some ongoing appropriations to domestic violence shelters, which we haven't had, and of course the bills that just got started and didn't pass in that area. But I think there's a lot of good attention on domestic violence as well. So.
Thank you. And thank you to all who are engaged in that effort in many, many ways. I think for next steps, just to kind of bring this public policy subcommittee report to an end here is next steps, I think, to we can follow the model that we saw with the family planning funding. This was Representative Ward's bill to provide contraception to low-income women who were not already covered. And he worked on getting that funding. I think it was $12 million. Worked on it
solid throughout interim. And so as we look forward to something like EITC that passes but doesn't get funded, paid family leave that passes but doesn't get funded, we need to use and leverage the support we had on the policy piece of this and start, like, this afternoon, in fact, at 12:30 today, begin working on getting funding for these efforts, because that's where our barrier was there. Second next step, I think, is to work with the interim committee chairs and work with them to prioritize our issues as they create their interim study item list. And the process for that is the interim chairs create a list, and usually the interim chairs are the House Standing Committee Chair and the Senate Standing Committee Chair, and they work together and they become the interim co-chairs. And they'll create a list, and then they go before the Legislative Management Committee. This is the leadership in both House and Senate, and they present what their ideas are. And they look at the list of items that have been submitted to leadership from all of the legislators. And then there's a discussion there, and the legislative leadership team gives some input, and then that becomes the interim list. Now, interim committees can still continue to hear presentations, and you know the interim chairs still create the agendas, but it's nice to have that little oomph behind them to have an official study item. So that I see as the second list is that as legislators on the commission we could step forward on that.
And the benefit that we have is the co-chair of the Women in the Economy Commission is also House Chair of our Workforce Development and Economic Development and Workforce Services Committee, so it's really helpful when Commissioner / Representative Edwards can drive that, but can put a little bit more, she has a little more power in terms of seeing what is put on her agenda, so that'll be very helpful also. Because a lot of it depends on where both the chairs as well as legislative leadership wants to see the direction of that committee.
Yeah.
Senator, yeah. Maybe also mention the infertility bill, because we, you know, in 2014, there was a bill that passed that allowed the insurance companies to provide. I mean, they have the opportunity to use the adoption indemnity funds towards fertility treatment by, you know, one of the members of their insurance, and or to use it towards adoption. No company was allowing that to happen. So we gave them 4 years. So this year we passed a bill where we're piloting a program like we did for autism coverage for infertility treatment through PHP first. So, you know, and I wanted all of them, but I learned they had to maybe bring it down a notch. But I was excited to have all of them do it. But it's been a uphill battle for many families. This is obviously impacting a lot of women, and it's actually very powerful to hear their stories. And I encourage the commission to get involved in this. And this is a healthcare. It's a healthcare condition. It's not. I mean, I just don't understand why it's not covered as a medical issue, even though it is a medical issue. So we're excited to see this 3 years of a pilot program and opportunities to seek other solutions. So right now those many of those families will be able to use up to $4,000 in if they have PEHP, which is all of our public employees' health care plan towards infertility. So it's a big, it passed the last 40 minutes or so, the last 20 minutes of session, so I'm excited. And you know, it was probably, I mean, I've been working with those families and those women for many years, and it's a victory, and many others that we, you know, that's been very hard to bring victories in that area. So, thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to talk about any other bills that are up or things that happened in the Senate?
Yeah, the other one will be after school. I mean, after school, we talk about daycare. After school is the same. I mean, if you're working and your kids get out of school at 3, so I've been running bills in after school, and it's been hard to get funding for that bill. So I run this year a bill for quality improvement as a private-public partnership. So we work with DWS and the state of USOE whatever they're called now. They change them here every year. The Office of Transportation. And they, what we did is we are, so I've been working with some private companies that are going to provide $250,000 as a match. So, you know, the funding, we actually got an appropriation for $250,000. So it's, the state money won't kick in until we get the private money in. And it's a competitive grant to bring quality improvement mechanisms to those after school programs. But I really, if you think about a mom or a parent without a quality after school programs, more children are in danger between 3 and 6 p.m. I mean, more things happen between 3 and 6 p.m. Not in the midnight, not at 3 in the morning. More children are high risk between 3 and 6 p.m. because that's when they're unsupervised. And if we don't have, and we hardly have anything, and the state has never done much on after school programs except for the, you know, the pass-through money that DWS oversees, which is federal money. Mm-hmm. So we have great institutions right now working on quality improvement of after school programs between, you know, USOE and DWS, that I think we need to just leverage that and get more services for families. So that's the other issue that I worked in. I'm excited that we got that bill passed as well. And thank you to DWS for helping us with that. So, like I said, I've been working with Kathy for 10 years. And now I know Kathy. You know, it took my meeting. See, Kathy? Thank you.
It's all hard.
As we're thanking DWS and Kathy and team, I just want to also thank her, as well as Voices for Nutritional, YWCA, Women's Coalition, Head Start folks, Utah PTA. There are so many people that helped us try to get the Early Childhood Commission and Council passed through. They've worked so hard getting it out. We got it out of the House. It was one of the members of the 38 Club. We barely squeaked it through with a yes vote. And we had Senator Milner and Senator Andrade in particular in the Senate, who are working really hard to persuade the senators, along with Kathy and team, to pass it in the Senate. We had the votes in the Senate, but it became a political pawn of the House the last week of the session, unfortunately. And so the reason that it didn't pass has nothing to do, I think, with the intent or the content of what the bill was and what it was presenting for. We reached the hurdles that we were running into at the beginning of this process, which was primarily from parental rights groups and folks that were concerned about the impact of a commission, a bureaucracy that worked on childhood learning issues and access issues for families. So it was frustrating to get through what you would see as the usual suspects in opposition, get it through the House, have it ready in the Senate, and then have it used in other ways to not move forward. And so we're going to find other ways to make sure that that happens, that I'm working with. Because sometimes there's administrative ways that we can get things done.
The war is not
to
over.
To be continued, ..
Oh, I think that's the theme that's the theme for the day, to be continued. Mm-hmm. Great work has occurred, and there is much more to be done. And in the words of Winston Churchill, we will have our send-off here to never, 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 never give up. This work is worth it. It's important. And we will continue. We have one final motion. Commissioner Bowman.
Oh, do you want me to make one? I think that's my one.
To adjourn?
To adjourn. Is that the right one? Okay.
Motion before us is to adjourn. Non-debatable. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, so you are adjourned. Thank you,
everyone.
Great
meeting.
Can we have a meeting?
We don't know.
Yeah.
Every other month, so we're going to.